Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 291 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 51. Okay, so let's get right into it. So what if they give you a question about a person that comes in and they tell you that they have like heartburn that is really bad at night? What should you be thinking about? Or they may tell you that they have like a cough that's really worse at night. What should you be thinking about? Or you should be thinking of those people potentially having GERD. Although that can also be a presentation of asthma on your exam, right? But this person likely has GERD, right? If a person has just regular garden variety GERD, what are you supposed to do for them? Well, I would hope you're telling me that you're going to give those people PPIs, right? PPIs are the first thing you do for people that have GERD. You do like a 6-week trial. But, you know, let's assume you've tried it and that's not cutting it. And sadly, you have to proceed to upper endoscopy, right? So you're going to do an EGD, right? The term for that is esophagogastroduodenoscopy, right? So you go ahead and push right straight to the EGD. And then, remember, there are some situations, let me call them maybe like almost like derivative situations where you may do things a little different, right? So if, for example, a person comes in with GERD symptoms, and they have like alarm symptoms in addition to that, right? So what are alarm symptoms? It can be that, you know, they are more than the age of 50. It can also be that they're having like dysphagia or dysphagia. Basically, whenever you see things that you're like, this person seems to have more than garden variety GERD or like extremely severe GERD, then you want to go ahead and do an EGD in those circumstances, right? And then don't forget, there are other people that can also get PPIs on your test, right? Remember, PPIs can be given to people that have had severe burns, right? Remember those curling ulcers that they can get in the stomach? And also people that have increased intracranial pressures. In fact, they can make this a stroke question on your exam, right? Like they can tell you, oh, brain imaging shows like global cerebral edema, yada, yada, yada. And then they ask for your next best step and it will be to give a PPI, right? And then remember, so if a person is going to be placed on a bisphosphonate for a prolonged period of time, they also need to be placed on a PPI at the same time, right? So that, again, you can protect the esophageal mucosa in a sense. And also, if you're going to be taking, not bisphosphonate, steroids. If a person is going to be taking steroids for a long period of time, steroids can cause peptic ulcer disease. Those people need to be placed on PPIs, right? And then remember, right, again, if a person had achalasia, right, remember you don't go straight to the EGD, right? I'm kind of talking around this EGD business, right? Remember, you do the barium studies first. You do the barium swallow. And then after that, you do the manometry, right? And then after you do the manometry, you go ahead and perform the EGD, right? Barium swallow will show you that bird's beak sign, right? And then the manometry will show you that, oh, they have like aperiostosis, right? Especially of the mid-esophagus, right? And then the EGD, right, is to rule out pseudoechalasia, because sometimes what you think is bird's beak is actually cancer, right? So an EGD helps you kind of rule that out. And again, please don't forget that achalasia, right, increases a person's risk of having squamous cell cancer of the esophagus. Okay. And then what if they give you a question about a patient that has Zenkers? Should you do an EGD with those people? Again, I would hope you don't do an EGD, right? Because again, in Zenkers, you can go ahead and perf the esophagus and then you have a whole new set of problems, right? So typically when a person has Zenkers, you don't do an EGD. When a person has Zenkers, what you're supposed to do is do the barium swallow, right? You'll see the problem around the cricothyroid membrane, right? And then you go ahead and fix it with a diverticulectomy, right? Remember, those are people, you'll be an old person, right? Zenkers is not a young person's disease, typically on in-beam exams. It's going to be an old person that, you know, they're having marital problems because the guy's mouth is usually men for whatever bizarre reason. The guy's mouth, you know, stinks up every time. And then he tells you that, oh, sometimes, you know, like some undigested food comes out in the morning from his mouth, right? If you see stuff like that, you want to think about Zenkers. Just do the barium. That's pretty much all you need to do, right? And you go ahead and fix the problem with surgery. You do a diverticulectomy. Although remember, Zenkers diverticulum, again, is another risk factor for esophageal squamous cell carcinoma, right? The biggest risk factor for squamous cell cancer of the esophagus is smoking, okay? I'll say that again. The biggest risk factor for squamous cell cancer of the esophagus is smoking. Just, you know, something to keep in mind. But the biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma is going to be Barrett's esophagus, right? Because, you know, get it from GERD and all that fun stuff. Okay, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that the patient is taking like two or three different antihypertensive drugs, and then they tell you that, oh, this person has peripheral edema, like swelling of the legs, right? What antihypertensive is going to be causing that peripheral edema? Well, I would hope you're telling me that, oh, it's going to be like some kind of dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So something like amlodipine, felodipine, right? Those dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, remember, they all cause peripheral edema, right? And the thing is, your friends at the MBA may actually expect you to know the mechanism behind said edema, right? So remember, the thing that happens is these drugs, they dilate arterioles, right? They dilate precapillary arterioles. So if you dilate those precapillary arterioles, remember, we have arterioles, then capillaries, then venules, right? So relative to the capillaries, the arterioles are pre. Relative to the capillaries, the venules are post, right? So those pre-capillary arterioles are dilated very powerfully by these dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? Again, like nifedipine, amlodipine, right? So because they dilate those pre-capillary arterioles, they send more blood to the capillaries, right? So that will increase the hydrostatic pressures within capillaries. Well, when you increase hydrostatic pressures within capillaries, sadly, the thing that's going to happen is you're going to have more fluid extravasation that's going to cause a peripheral edema. So your friends at the MBME sometimes can ask you, how can you prevent this edema or treat this edema? Well, it's actually kind of high yield to know that you give those people an ACE inhibitor, right? So remember, ACE inhibitors, they are very powerful post-capillary venule dilators, right? So remember, it's almost like a concept. ACE inhibitors are very good at dilating blood vessels that come after capillary beds, right? So they dilate these post-capillary venules. If you do that, you'll take away more blood from these capillaries, right? So you will decrease the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries, and that would ultimately help the patient. If you're thinking in terms of that post-capillary whatever dilation, also think in terms of the kidneys, right? Remember, we have the glomerular capillaries, the capillary system that comes right after it. That's the efferent arteriole. The efferent arteriole is preferentially dilated by ACE inhibitors and ARBs, right? So again, just very high yield to know that. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has a history of a Crohn's disease, and then the person over the last 2-3 days has been having a lot of vomiting, a lot of nausea, not able to keep any food down, person hasn't had any bowel movements. If you see that, what do you want to think about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about like strictures, right, from the Crohn's disease. Remember, Crohn's loves to cause strictures. And those strictures, right, they can cause a small bowel obstruction, right? So whenever you see a person with an inflammatory bowel disease, especially Crohn's, like almost like 99% of the time on NBM exams is going to be Crohn's, and then they have like small bowel obstruction symptoms, think about strictures as the cause, right? And then remember, people that have Crohn's, if they ask you about the nephrolithiasis they have, what should you be thinking of? Well, I'd hope you're thinking about like calcium oxalate nephrolithiasis, right? Again, remember, their terminal ileums don't work. So if it doesn't work, you're going to reabsorb a ton of oxalate, and you're going to get those oxalate crystals. Remember, oxalate crystals are actually the most common kind of nephrolithiasis, at least that pops up on exams, and actually also in the real world as well, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient that has pneumonia, and they tell you that, oh, this patient is a big time smoker, you know, 2 packs per day for like 40 years or something ridiculous, and they have pneumonia. And usually when they do this, for whatever bizarre reason, they love to make these questions like super non-specific, right? They won't give you any clues, they won't give you any sputum culture, anything, right? And then you're supposed to figure it out. Well, what I'll just say is, if you ever see a person that has COPD on your exam and they have pneumonia, always think about H. influenza. Haemophilus influenza is actually one of the most common causes, especially on MBMEs, of pneumonia in patients that have COPD, right? And remember, if it's H flu, you're going to go ahead and treat that with a ceftriaxone. You're going to use a third generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime. Now, I think one other thing that maybe bears mentioning here is just kind of talking about some of the classic MBME scenarios where ceftriaxone or cefotaxime, you know, these third generation cephalosporins are the right answer. If we're still thinking in terms of pneumonia, for sure, they are definitely the right answer in a person that has a pneumococcal pneumonia. Ceftriaxone works like a charm in those circumstances. That's one. Another important one is if you see a person that has SBP, right? Again, it'll be an alcoholic or a person that has like liver issues, right? They'll have like this fluid wave. They'll have mild abdominal tenderness. They'll have altered mental status. Well, what are you supposed to do for those folks? Well, I would hope you tell me that, let's do a paracentesis, right? Again, read your questions carefully. The MBME is fond of doing this. When you're asking about SBP, they'll put paracentesis as an answer. But then they'll put many other kinds of synthesis, thoracentesis, pericardiocentesis, right? In fact, for sure, they love that pericardiocentesis because the P's kind of match. C kind of looks a lot like O, especially in the heat of an exam, you know, you're kind of all emotional, right? So pericardiocentesis, paracentesis, right? So just make sure you're doing the paracentesis, right? That's where you draw fluid from the abdomen, right? So remember what you're looking for. It's not even the box that will tell you anything. You're looking for more than 200 or more. So if you, 250 or more neutrophils, right? If you find 250 or more neutrophils, right? That tells you all you need. Person has been SBP. And then you go ahead and give them a third-gen cephalosporin for those purposes. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has celiac disease? How can you differentiate on in-beam exams? How can you differentiate celiac disease from lactase deficiency? This is a common mistake many med students make, right? So what are the big differences? Here's what I'll tell you. If you see the person have any lab or physical exam abnormalities, it's going to be celiac disease, right? If you see any lab or physical exam abnormalities like vitamin D deficiency or iron deficiency anemia or anything of that sort, or the person has lost like precipitous amounts of weight, seems malnourished, always think about celiac disease. People that have lactase deficiency, they almost never on NBMEs lose like tons of weight or have lab abnormalities or anything like that, right? So I think that's something that can actually help you pretty significantly on exams, right? And again, remember, people that have celiac disease, they can actually make an endocrine question of it, right? So these people, if the celiac disease involves their terminal ileum, right? Remember, they can have like B12 deficiency as a result of that. They can get a vitamin D deficiency, right? Because they're not going to be able to reabsorb these fat-soluble vitamins, right? So they can get a vitamin D deficiency, so they can have like low calcium, right? And because they're not reabsorbing it in the gut. And if that's the case, then PTH is going to rise, right? And that PTH, remember, we call it the phosphate trashing hormone. So it's going to, you know, trash the phosphate. So their phosphate will be low, right? Their phosphate is going to be low, right? So because their kidneys actually work, right? So just something to kind of keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? And then another classic thing that the NBMEs test a lot is at least, you know, they can give you a question about a child that has ADHD, and they tell you that, you know, he has like a very long face, very big testicles. What should you be thinking about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about Fragile X syndrome, right? Remember, Fragile X syndrome is one of these high-yield trinucleotide repeat disorders to know for exams. Remember, it's inherited in an X-linked dominant fashion. Remember, it's one of two high-yield X-linked dominant diseases you need to know for your NBM exams. The other one, if I'm not mistaken, is going to be, Alport's, right? Alport's syndrome. Alport syndrome is X-linked dominant. Fragile X syndrome is also X-linked dominant. Alport syndrome, remember, right? It's the COL 4A5 gene mutation, right? So the alpha 5 chain of type 4 collagen has issues. It just so happens that type 4 collagen, we express it a lot in basement membranes, so that's why their kidneys are screwed. You also express it in the eyes, right? So that's why they have eye problems and also hearing problems as well. So X-linked dominant, right? And again, Fragile X is also X-linked dominant, right? But let's get back to what I really wanted to talk about, right? The trinucleotide repeat disorders. Remember, the trinucleotide repeat disorders, we have Fragile X, right? Remember, it's those CGG, trinucleotide repeats, right? And then another classic one is going to be Friedreich's ataxia. Friedreich's ataxia is kind of unique. It doesn't have any kind of dominant inheritance. The inheritance pattern is actually autosomal recessive, right? And those are GAA trinucleotide repeats, right? GAA trinucleotide repeats. So just something to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? And then don't forget that the other ones have autosomal dominant inheritance, right? You know, like Huntington's, you'll be a person like coriform movements, and you know, they do inappropriate things, say inappropriate things. It's going to be a person in their 40s or early 50s or late 30s, right? So if you see that, think about Huntington's disease. I remember it's a chromosome 4 problem, right? So they'll have like atrophy of the caudate, and you have those CAG trinucleotide repeats. And don't forget that people that have Huntington's, right, especially these autosomal dominant disorders just in general, right, they can begin to reflect like genetic principles like anticipation, right, where, you know, they start having symptoms earlier and they have like a very like worse phenotype as you go across generations, right? And then remember that the last trinucleotide repeat disorder to know about, don't forget your myotonic dystrophy, right? So you'll be a person that has trouble, the physician has trouble releasing his grip from said patient, or it can be a patient that has trouble opening doors, right? Or they can give you like a guy in his 20s, very young, and he's already bald. Whenever you see stuff like that, you want to think about myotonic dystrophy. And remember, myotonic dystrophy actually involves CTG, trinucleotide repeats, right? And the actual gene that's all messed up, right? It's like a kinase, if I'm not mistaken. It's like the DMPK gene, right? So the DMPK gene doesn't work very well in people that have a myotonic dystrophy, right? So those are your four trinucleotide repeat disorders. So I'm just going to summarize them real quick, right? So remember, Huntington's disease, CAG trinucleotide repeats, autosomal dominant inheritance. Myotonic dystrophy, CTG trinucleotide repeats, autosomal dominant inheritance. Fragile X syndrome, CGG trinucleotide repeats, X-linked dominant inheritance. And then Friedreich's ataxia, GAA trinucleotide repeats. So GAA trinucleotide repeats, and autosomal recessive inheritance, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient and, you know, they tell you that this patient says, oh, whenever he's going up and downstairs, he has double vision, right? So this person almost has like vertical diplopia, right? Like if you see that, what should you be thinking about? Well, I would hope you're thinking about Parinaud syndrome, right? I hope you're thinking about Parinaud syndrome, right? It's a problem with the superior colliculus on MBM exams, right? So remember, your superior colliculus is your vertical gaze center. So if it doesn't work, you're going to get in a lot of trouble, right? So what are the things that can cause a problem with the superior colliculus? Well, there's one that many people know, and then there's one that is unusual, but is tested. So you want to know about it, right? It's kind of unusual. It's not in many resources, but it's really high yield to know, right? So remember, one is a pineloma. Because remember, the pineal gland is superior to the superior colliculus, right? The pineal gland, I'll say that again, is superior to the superior colliculus. So if a person has a pineloma, that's going to compress the superior colliculus, right? And that's going to cause Parinaud syndrome. Another thing that can also cause Parinaud syndrome, if you remember your circle of Willis, right? Remember your basilar artery, you know, it gives off AICA first, the anterior inferior cerebellar arteries, right? And then after that, it gives off the paramedian pontine arteries, right? Which supply the medial pons. Remember, AICA supplies the lateral pons. But then if you're going more terminal for the basilar artery, it gives off the superior cerebellar artery. The superior cerebellar artery is the principal arterial supply to the superior colliculus, right? So it's easy to remember, superior cerebellar artery supplies the superior colliculus. If a person has a stroke or an infarct or whatever of the superior cerebellar artery, that's going to cause problems with the superior colliculus, right? That's going to definitely cause problems with the superior colliculus. Now, there are three drugs I almost want to compare and contrast. So these are things that, because I mean, as many people know, your friends at the MBME, they love these things where they test some step one pharmacology, right? And again, many people, you know, usually forget this stuff, right? So let's kind of talk about this. I want to compare and contrast three antiplatelet drugs, right? Although the first thing I'll establish, remember, antiplatelet drugs are not the same thing as anticoagulants, right? Anticoagulants work on they inhibit secondary hemostasis. Antiplatelet drugs inhibit primary hemostasis, right? So what do I want to make a big fuss about here? Well, the big fuss I want to make here is that it's actually very high yield to know that aspirin, right, inhibits cyclooxygenase. I know you may be like, oh, fine, that makes sense, kind of obvious. But let me explain what I mean, right? So does aspirin cause a net vasoconstriction or a net vasodilation? Well, I hope you're telling me that it actually causes a net vasoconstriction, right? Because remember, aspirin is a COX inhibitor, so it will decrease the synthesis of prostaglandins. If you decrease the synthesis of prostaglandins, right, you're going to get less vasodilation, more vasoconstriction. This is one of the reasons why aspirin can cause renal failure, right? Because essentially, it's an NSAID, it will inhibit COX, you'll make less prostaglandins, right? So you're going to constrict the afferent arterial. And if you do that, that's going to raise your renin levels and all those things, right? And again, if you also constrict your afferent arterial, you're not going to be perfusing your kidneys very well, your glomerular capillaries. So that's going to cause a decrease in GFR. So your creatinine is going to go up, right? So that's one end of the spectrum where we have an antiplatelet agent that is it's antiplatelet, but it's a vasoconstrictor, right? But the thing is, there is also an antiplatelet agent that on the flip side is a vasodilator, right? So you're thinking more along the lines of those phosphodiesterase inhibitors. So drugs like celostazol and dipyridamole, right? So celostazol and dipyridamole, the way they work is they inhibit phosphodiesterase, and that's going to raise the person's levels of cyclic AMP. The thing is, high levels of cyclic AMP actually inhibit the function of platelets, right? So whenever your cyclic AMP is high, you're not going to be able to express GP2B3A on the surface of a platelet, right? If you cannot express GP2B3 on the surface of a platelet, then you cannot have the aggregation step of primary hemostasis, right? So that's how those drugs like celostazole and dipyridamole work. I mean, that's why celostazole is used to treat peripheral arterial disease after you've tried the 30 minutes of, you know, supervised walking and it doesn't work. So you can do celostazole. It's an antiplatelet drug, right? But it's also a very powerful vasodilator. And then remember, dipyridamole is another one, right? But dipyridamole is not used for PAD. Dipyridamole can be used as like a third line agent. If a person has like carotid stenosis, as pharmacological therapy, remember, first line, you're going to use aspirin. Second line is clopidogrel. Third line is dipyridamole. But if none of those work, if, you know, if aspirin is not an answer on MBMEs, that's first line. If clopidogrel is not around, right, that's second line, then you can go to dipyridamole. Remember, we also use dipyridamole to, in the coronary steel principle, when we're doing these pharmacological stress tests. I've talked about this coronary steel principle in multiple podcasts in the past, right? So again, remember, aspirin is on one end of the spectrum. It's antiplatelet, but it's a vasoconstrictor. And then dipyridamole, celostazole, those phosphodiesterase inhibitors, they're on another end of the spectrum. They are antiplatelet agents, but they are vasodilators. Okay, they are vasodilators. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. As I do, again, if you're interested in the step one or step two CK courses or the MBME test taking strategies course, just shoot me an email through the website. I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. Remember, the step one course is taking place from the 5th to the 9th of April. It's 5 days, it's 40 hours total. And we're going to be reviewing about 4,000 concepts from all the MBME disciplines. And again, a lot of these things, I'm going to go over them with vignettes, right? I'm going to do a lot of integration. So I may be covering neuro, but I may at the same time be covering biochem and hemonc and pathology. And so I'm just going to move around a lot, but at the end you will learn a ton from the course. It's going to be from, you know, again, from the 5th to the 9th of April, from 7 to 10 a.m noon to 3 p.m and 4 to 6 p.m this is all Pacific Standard Time, right? So that'll be 3 hours behind Eastern Standard Time. And then from a step 2 CK perspective, I'm having a step 2 CK, actually step 3, so this course is combined as a step 2 CK step 3 course. I'm going to be doing that from the 25th to the 27th of April. It's going to be 16 and a half hours, right? So it's from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on all 3 days. And then I have an MBME test taking strategies class. Again, this is more for people taking step 2 CK step 3. It's going to be on the 24th of April from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Again, all these classes are over Zoom. Tons of people have taken these classes. They've done extremely well on the exams. I mean, I'll say probably the highest score I've gotten from my courses for a person that attended, this person, I'm not going to say the exact score because it can be personally identifying, but I'm pretty sure this person got just a few points under a 280, right? So again, if you're interested in these courses, again, hundreds of people have taken them, especially the Step 2 CK Step 3 course. So if you're interested, shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you some more details on registering. So thank you for listening to the podcast. Please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then I have this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. So please subscribe. And then I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention USMLE Podcast and Videos. That's where I put my videos, right? So thank you for listening to this. I wish you a wonderful weekend. God bless you. See you next time. Thank you.